and welcome along to the Property Academy podcast. I'm your host, Edward Knight.
And I'm Andrew Nicol.
And today on the show, we're talking about the new responsible lending code. Oh, that is right. We are talking about the new Credit Contracts and Consumer Finance Act, which is soon to be released. Actually, it's quite interesting, Andrew. The date for it being introduced has actually been pushed out by 2 months because of the current COVID situation we find ourselves in. But the impact for investors is that some lending is about to get tougher for some specific people. So what's actually happened? Well, at the moment, you've got the Responsible Lending Code, which we've mentioned quite a bit on this show. Now, that is a voluntary code that all of the banks have adopted, which has made it tougher for some investors and would-be borrowers to go and borrow money. Now, what's the change? Well, what the new Act, the Credit Contracts and Consumer Finance Act, does is it takes most of the Responsible Lending Code and instead of making it voluntary, it makes it compulsory. So it says that any non-bank lender, anybody giving out a credit contract, anybody doing consumer finance, has to take most of this responsible lending code and follow it. So it's taking what used to be voluntary, making it compulsory. And as part of this, a new responsible lending code is being released as well. Now, it's quite interesting, Andrew, and I know we'll get into this a little bit more, but most of what's being provided for in the legislation doesn't actually change the responsible lending code. It's just that it's gone from the voluntary to compulsory, but that doesn't mean that there isn't going to be a change in how people operate, but we'll get into that. But just walk us through, what is the purpose of moving from this voluntary code to a compulsory code and putting it in legislation from the government's perspective? What are they trying to achieve?
Okay, so the main thing is that the government is concerned about the level of debt that's out there and also, I guess, the types of loans that people are getting. You know, one of the big things that has come under scrutiny over the last wee while is payday loans, for example. So these are the loans that if you can't meet your normal weekly bills, you can go to a payday loan place like Moolah. They'll give you a $500 loan and it's for 7 days or something like that, but they're at a what seems like a relatively low interest rate, but when you spread it all out over an annualized interest rate, it can be quite high. So the government are wanting to make sure, A, that people are getting appropriate loans for what they need and that it's sustainable and that they're not entering into contracts that are considered usury. And there's actually a quote here from David Clark, Minister of Commerce and Consumer Affairs, that New Zealand has one of the highest household debt levels in the world and around 18% of borrowers have reported difficulties on making their loan repayments and that they're having a negative impact on their everyday life. So obviously the government doesn't want people stressing about money. They don't want there to be an underworld where you can go and borrow all this money and then get yourself into more and more trouble if you are under financial duress as it is.
Just briefly, let's talk about what's actually within the legislation. It's only about a 14-page document, which was actually quite good when we actually went through and read what the Act is. It basically says the banks already have to do what they're already doing, and people who are giving out credit need to do two things. They need to make sure that any lending is A, suitable for the consumer's needs, and B, that it is affordable for the consumer to be able to go through. Now, that does mean that the banks and other people providing credit need to try and understand what is the buyer really trying to do and then see whether it's appropriate. Now, this actually makes me a bit concerned, Andrew, because what's provided for in the legislation, when you read the Act, what it says is that banks need to make sure that the right product is being provided. Now, I think that's a good thing, because then they're going to be saying, okay, cool, are we providing the right product for the consumer's decision? So that might be that the consumer wants credit for $5,000 and they want to go and spend it on renovations. Now, there are different products that the consumer could potentially get. They could get a credit card, they could get an overdraft, they could get a revolving credit. And what the bank has to do is figure out, well, what's the right product for this consumer's decision? I think that's a good thing because finance is difficult to figure all this out. Now, my worry is that in practice, the way it could be implemented is that banks or other institutions might try and decide whether it is the right decision for the consumer. I'm a wee bit worried about how this is going to be implemented. I think the purpose of the Act is great. I am a bit worried about how it's going to potentially be implemented. Do you understand what I mean in terms of like an institution trying to decide whether the consumer's decision is correct or not?
Absolutely. And I know we've spoken a lot on webinars and podcasts about doing things to free up your servicing. So, for example, if you've got a car loan and you're paying 15% on that at the moment over a five-year period, or maybe it was interest-free, and then coming to your bank and saying, hey, look, I'm happy to pay 3%. I want to add it onto my mortgage and spread that over the term of my loan, which is 27 years remaining. Yes, I'm going to pay more interest in the long term. Banks technically can't do that under this act. So that's where I've seen people kicked back for this. So this is where you have to maybe put a bit more pressure on the bank that actually I'm making an informed decision as a consumer about what I want, and I'm going to increase the payments on my mortgage to mitigate the fact that I'm paying interest on that loan now. But there are times where banks are saying no to adding that loan onto your mortgage because the asset type, i.e. a car which depreciates over 5 years, is an appropriate for a home loan product.
Now, what else is quite interesting about what's expressly provided in the Act, they are talking about that banks, and this won't surprise any long-term listeners, they need to take out any regular or frequently recurring outgoings. So payments that you were making when they are assessing, can you afford this loan or not? But let's look at the examples that the Act actually gives in legislation. So gym memberships, entertainment costs. Yep, that makes sense. If you're regularly paying a gym membership, take that out of somebody's expenses because they don't have that $50 a week or $50 a month in order to be able to put that towards servicing some sort of lending. But what else do they say in the Act? Tithing. We've talked about that in the past as well, about if you're paying $200 a week to your church, even though you could stop doing that if interest rates increase, they're going to count that as an expense. What else is interesting? Savings and investments is specifically said in the Act that those could be considered frequent outgoings, and that even if you are saving money, that could be considered an expense in the bank's eyes. Now, to be fair, the legislation also does say that it is specifically if you're unable or unwilling to cease that after the agreement, so after you enter into an agreement to borrow some money, that you wouldn't be able to stop doing that. But it's interesting that it's in there within the legislation. Would you not agree, Andrew?
What I think is that the banks have to be really careful about looking at things and understanding that people will change their habits to adjust with their new responsibility, which might be a mortgage. People pay their mortgage first. That's just the truth. People pay their rent on their mortgage first. And if you're going out for dinner all the time, you can adjust some of those expenses. But the bank obviously wants to make sure that you are showing habits that would support that. One of the interesting things is, you know, things like KiwiSaver, which I'm going to come back to later on. But the tithing one's a really interesting one. I don't know if I've told this story before, but years and years and years ago when I was a mortgage broker, about 15 years ago, I remember submitting a loan application to Pioneer Mortgages. And Daryl, who was their credit manager, rang me and he said, no, these people pay $300 a week to the church. They can't afford it. And I said, well, it's an offering. They can stop that. And he said, no, they can't. They have to make that payment. I said, Daryl, trust me, as a man of God, I know you can change these payments. You can make this adjustment. And he said, no, I'm not accepting this unless you get a letter from who's in charge that they can stop it. So I said, shall we go get a letter from God then? And I was actually going to get it and mock up a letter for him, but I didn't do that. I just went to another bank at that stage. But it's one of those things that people are actually able to make their own decisions around where their money goes. And so something like tithing, you know, that's quite a challenging one. I know a lot of people that make those generous offerings to their church aren't going to want to necessarily go to their pastor and ask for a letter to say that it's okay.
And I think it's important to note that the intentions of this legislation are actually really well-meaning, and you can certainly see that this would be very beneficial for people who are perhaps not as clued up on their finances and who possibly might rely on the bank not as a financial advisor, but to give them a little more financial advice than they might otherwise get.
To protect them.
Yeah, but in some instances, if you are clued up, it could throw a little hurdle in front of you, I think would be fair to say.
So what effect does the ministry think the legislation will have on the market? So the Ministry of Consumer Affairs thinks the following things are going to happen. Firstly, that finance companies, banks, lending institutions are going to use these benchmarks to ensure that living expenses being provided or estimated by their borrowers are realistic. So if you say that you spend $1,000 a month, but you've got four kids and a wife and three cars, probably that's unrealistic. So at that stage, they're going to have a benchmark to say, actually, based on our statistics, it's more likely that's going to be $3,500, just made up numbers. Don't text in and say I'm wildly wrong. The other thing that's probably likely to happen is that banks are going to take more time actually going through and verifying that those are realistic to what you're spending at the moment. So if you say that you're spending $3,500 and then they go through your bank statements and find out that actually there's $4,000 going out just in food and entertainment, then that's unrealistic for you. So whilst the benchmark might say that, it's not true for you as an individual. And so at that stage, they're going to start to challenge those things. And of course, the hard part about this is it's probably going to push out the time for an approval, because if the banks are taking more time to go through line by line on your bank statement and figure out actually how much money are you spending, how much of that discretion money are you spending at the moment, that's going to take a little bit longer. Two of the banks have actually said that they're investing in software to help go through bank statements and transaction records. So you might see a bit more of this. You might see a bit more of the fintech space being focused on looking at what people's expenses are. And maybe tools like PocketSmith, people are using things like PocketSmith. If you're using tools like that at the moment, you might find that your application goes through a bit faster because you're supplying that information. Brokers might start asking for that.
And I think it's important, and I know we'll talk about this in a second, but if you are putting in a mortgage application, this new environment, and we've got to see how banks are actually going to implement this, right? Because what's provided for in legislation is actually no tougher than what they're already doing, but they might change the way in which they interpret the code. One thing you might be able to do is, can you demonstrate over the 3 months of your bank statements that you've got to hand over when you're applying for a mortgage, can you demonstrate that you can live more frugally? You know, over that 3 month period, can you live a little bit more simply so you're able to get your lending over the line? That is, just to be really clear, in no means to try and defraud the bank. We would never suggest that. But simply to demonstrate that the numbers you're putting down on a mortgage application you can actually meet.
Absolutely. I think Ed's right on the money there. I know that brokers in the past might have put down a lower number than expected expenses purely because, you know, that makes it work for servicing. And this is one of the benefits that come from this. If you, as the borrower, are forced to test yourself and see if you actually can genuinely afford this changed level of commitment, then it puts you in that habit mode where when you do have that mortgage, you can definitely afford it. So I think that's actually a real positive.
So what do we expect that institutions are actually going to do? Hey, look, I think they're going to reduce the amount of rental income, that if you want to buy an investment property, how much of that income they'll include in your servicing calculations. I've heard from a couple of mortgage brokers that it might go down to 50 or 60%. That would make it pretty tough. I'd expect as well that if non-bank lenders continued their quote-unquote pragmatic approach or less conservative approach, I would expect that they may not bring down their rental shading to the same degree. I think there's going to be more value judgments by the banks. So if you're the sort of person who is continually going and putting something on your mortgage, so increasing the size of your mortgage by 10 grand so you can go overseas on a holiday once the borders open back up, then the banks might make a value judgment and say, you know what, it might not be the appropriate decision for you to bang 10K onto your mortgage and pay that off over 15 years. That's not a good financial decision. They may make that sort of value judgment. I think they'll be definitely taking a tougher look at expenses to make sure that what you're putting down on the mortgage application is actually what they're seeing in those statements. And I think there's going to be much tougher treatment of bonus and commission income. Because a big part of what's provided for in the legislation is they're saying we want to make sure that even if somebody is being too conservative on their expenses and overestimating their income, that they'd still be able to afford this lending that they're going for. So they're going to be tougher on expenses and tougher on treatment of variable income. I think those are going to be the big things. And minimum expenses, minimum living expenses may increase. One thing we might see, Andrew, that I've been thinking about is, well, maybe they will change the minimum living expenses based on your income, if they expect that people who are living on higher incomes would spend more. Now, that's totally speculative. I haven't read anything that suggests that that would actually happen, but I expect that that could happen if we're talking about relying on statistical models.
Well, actually, to be fair, that was how it worked in the past. So when you'd have a debt servicing ratio, that was exactly it. So they'd say BNZ, for example, if you're earning 100 grand a year, you could have 35% of that would be your debt servicing ratio, because they would assume that a third of it goes to tax, a third of it could go to debt or savings, and a third of it was living. And if your income went up, so did your expenses and your tax. So I think that that will probably be likely. So how should investors respond? So mortgage brokers are going to become even more important, because they stop you presenting a deal to the bank that's just not going to work. Because as we know, getting a yes after you've had a no is so much harder than just getting a yes the first time round, but with a bit of prep work. I think that savings habits need to be clear and be demonstrated. So if you are working with a mortgage broker, ask them what it needs to be and live your life as if you had that extra debt today. So show that for the next few months that you've created that habit. If, for example, you've got a turnkey build due for completion in 12 months' time, and let's say your contribution was $100 a week towards that, put aside that $100 a week for the next year. Show that you can afford that. I think that these are really good habits. And if you've got to make those adjustments to, i.e. the extra payments to your KiwiSaver, if you're putting 8% into KiwiSaver and you're only getting 3% matched by your employer, and you've decided, okay, well, actually, I'm going to change it so that that extra 5% is going into a managed fund that I can access, do that today. Show that you're serious about this. You're not just saying it to get the mortgage. If you're going to have a boarder in the house when you move into your own house, go and get the boarder now. Put them into your flat and show that you can live with other people and get that money hitting your account. Show that you're true to what you're going to do financially, and you're far more likely to get that approval the first time.
Just before we wrap up, want to read you another review that we've received. This one says, cracking good podcast. It's a 5-star review. Lads, great podcast. Have learned a heap. Unbelievable that you could deliver a quality podcast every day, but somehow you managed to do it. That comes from JB_New Zealand. Wonder if that's John Bolton from Squirrel. That'd be pretty cool if it was. And if it's not, that's cool too. Thank you, JB, for giving us that review. Really appreciate it. And please don't forget to write a review and subscribe to the podcast. It seriously does help us climb up those rankings and get the message out to more people. And make sure you tune in tomorrow, because we're talking about, how do I buy a luxury expensive house? We're going to be talking about what you would need to do to buy a $22.5 million house. It is going to be a cracker of an episode.
Cracker instead of banger this time around.
Thanks for listening to the Property Academy podcast. I'm your host, Evan Knight.
And I'm Andrew Nicholl.
And we're going to be back again tomorrow with even more daily strategies, tactics, and insights to help you get the most out of the New Zealand property market. Until next time.